noteworthy here. She was deeply attracted to the Eucharist and was reading the poetry of George Herbert, to whom she was introduced at Solesmes. She mentions in particular his poem, Love Bade Me Welcome, of which she was later to say it brought her into Christ's presence. And she came to the conclusion that the name of God and the name of Christ have been more and more irresistibly mingled in my thoughts, she wrote. As an aside, I recently heard a poet say, I must write, for I serve not only this generation, but the next. And when I heard him say that, I immediately thought of Simone Weil reading George Herbert's poetry. George Herbert, poet and evangelist. The persecution of the Jews in the late 1930s forced her and her family to leave France, but prior to her departure in Marseille, she met a Dominican priest, Father Purin, to whom she would eventually dedicate her book, Waiting for God. She was trying to decide whether to become a Catholic, and he was the one who led her through an understanding of the central mysteries of the faith, the Trinity, the Incarnation, the cross, and the resurrection. They made their way as a family to the United States and lived for a while in New York City. Eventually, she made her way to England, where she died at only 34 years of age. Despite her positive affiliation with the Christian faith, she remained antagonistic to her own Jewish heritage, in fact, to anything Jewish, including anything Jewish in Christianity. For example, she refused to believe that God could speak through the Old Testament prophets. And despite her positive experiences of the church in Rome and in Assisi and in Solesmes, she was never able to reconcile herself to the church hierarchy. I can only speculate about what might have happened if she had not experienced a premature death. She also refused to be baptized. I'd like to think that in time she would have been reconciled to her heritage, perhaps, and further, that in time she would perhaps have been able to come to terms with the phenomena of the institutional church. We don't know, of course, though it's noteworthy that in her time in New York, she went to church daily, and we know that she urged her brother to have his children baptized. More briefly, on George Grant. George Grant, born in 1918, is perhaps the most significant Canadian philosopher prior to Charles Taylor, especially when it comes to an articulation of the primacy of experience for theology and philosophy. He argued that experience rightly understood moves us to thought rightly expressed. I repeat, he argued that experience rightly understood moves us into thought that is rightly expressed. He was born, baptized, and raised an Anglican. And this seems to have provided him with the language, the context, a significant referent for his later religious experience. Most notable, though, is that Grant's coming to faith cannot be appreciated except against the backdrop of the Second War. As a young man, he felt compelled to participate in World War II, but he was a pacifist, and thus it had to be in a nonviolent way. He went to London and served as an air raids precautions warden, managing curfews, blackouts, investigating unexploded bombs, providing first aid, and the most difficult task of all, and indeed towards the end, this was all that he did every day, informing the families of those who had been killed. Can you imagine that as your daily job? It was this exposure to suffering that left Grant deeply in emotional and spiritual upheaval. His inner life could not make sense of it all. He could not contend with the circumstances of suffering in which he lived and worked and to which he had to witness each day. In the midst of the turmoil, he tells of a unique experience. He was making a delivery to a farm just outside of London, and as he dismounted from his bicycle to open and pass through the gate into the front yard, he tells how it suddenly came to him that God is. In his own commentary on this experience, Grant speaks of a deep confidence that he knew that in the end, all will be finally well, and that there is order behind this chaos, that this destruction does not have the last word, that evil does not have the last word. But he also realized that in this moment, he was not his own, that he belonged to another. And indeed, he had been taken into something mysterious, tremendous, and he was overwhelmed by the awareness that someone else out there loved him. In an insightful study of Grant's thought, Harris Athanasiadis, a Greek name, I can't quite say it, makes some noteworthy observations about the intersection of this man's thought and his experience of both suffering and grace. He notes that for Grant, he then realized that there is no rational or causal connection between the experience of suffering and the experience of God. and that indeed the experience of suffering is essential if we are to know God. For as this author puts it, without entering into the experiential truth of suffering, the experience of God cannot be trusted to be real. Otherwise, it's just subjective. It's just escapist. So that the experience of the cross without the resurrection leads to despair. But the experience of the resurrection without the cross cannot but lead to false, triumphalistic, and escapist hope. What Grant experienced as he opened the gate then became the major theme of his writing, that the experience of divine grace is found in the midst of the reality of suffering and tragedy in a deeply fragmented world. And the intersection of the two, of course, is found in the cross of Christ. Paul Williams is currently professor of philosophy at the University of Bristol. He was raised by what he describes as a not particularly religious family. He was baptized in Anglican as a young boy and sang in an Anglican church choir, but as a young man, he did not pursue the Anglican or the Christian option. Rather, he lost contact with the church, and when he went to university, chose to study philosophy, and in the course of his studies, developed an interest in Indian philosophy and thought, and eventually completed his doctorate at Oxford with a growing interest, a personal interest in Buddhism. It was not merely an academic interest. By 1973, he had come to the conclusion that he would become a Buddhist, and he formally became a Buddhist when he took refuge, to use the language of the Tibetan tradition. In time, he had a rather prominent role, and perhaps some of you heard him in that role within British Buddhist circles, teaching not only at the university, but also entering into radio programs and public interfaith dialogue, and would often debate Christian scholars. Yet now he is a Christian, and his autobiographical reflections entitled An Unexpected Way are indeed an interesting, a fascinating narrative as he describes the various factors that led to his conversion. Part of what interests me about Paul Williams' conversion is that most of the non-Christians with whom I'm in conversation are Buddhist. And I don't live in Thailand. I don't live in Tibet. I live in Vancouver. Now you're thinking, oh yeah, Vancouver, you just rolled your eyes. These people are kind of off the deep end out there. Perhaps those of us from the West Coast, we had a Californian this morning and a Pacific Northwest, although we call it the Pacific Southwest. But if you look at the map, it's the Pacific Southwest. But anyways, I want to be, seeker-sensitive this evening. But I want to just say, I think this conversion narrative merits reading in part because I suspect that many people will first become Buddhists before they become Christians. That for whatever reason, the kinds of people that I'm in conversation with, Christianity makes no sense. It doesn't connect at all. But Buddhism seems safe ground to talk about the spiritual life. And it may well be that if that's the case, the worst thing that we should do is diss, as my sons would put it, Buddhism. That it may well be a safe place in which we can say, yeah, this makes sense to me. I can understand why you become a Buddhist. We don't, in a sense, need to disparage it. It may well be a stepping stone to something that is, of course, more congruent with reality in due time. He describes, Paul Williams does, how he was not able to shake his early Christian roots and the fact that he was baptized a Christian. And he has this fascinating description of how when he would visit Christian churches, he felt like he wanted to be part of what had happened in these churches. That is, he spoke of it, he used this image, he says, imagine arriving at a place where a party had been and everybody had left already, the party's over, but you wished you'd been invited. He says, that's how I felt every time I went to a church. And he began to wonder if he'd really given Christianity a chance. He began to ask himself if he'd really considered the claims of the Christian faith. He also speaks of a dilemma he felt, a discomfort or unhappiness when chanting Tibetan, particularly a phrase in Tibetan that sounded like the word Jesus, and he didn't want to say the name Jesus. But beyond this, he was increasingly feeling an unease with dimensions of Buddhist practice and thought. In terms of thought, he was struck by the emphasis in Buddhism on positive experiences, on the positive benefits of meditation and the need to avoid suffering, essentially a religion of self-empowerment, of pleasant feelings and calm. And Williams began to see that while all of this sounded good, was it truly a basis for being a Buddhist, and did it help him make sense of the suffering in this world? Over time, his convictions about Buddhism began to weaken. For example, he began to wonder about the Buddhist emphasis on self-development, that one achieves perfection through self-power, through one's own efforts. But the most crucial thing for him was the conclusion that Buddhism was hopeless, that as far as Buddhism is concerned, there is no real significance to the human person, since the human person in the end converges on nothing. He came to this extraordinary conclusion: if Buddhism is correct, then this life will be the end for me and all my loved ones. If Buddhism is right, then finally, for almost all of us, our little lives count for virtually nothing. In contrast, he came to see that if Christianity is right, our lives, as the lives of individual persons as we are infinitely valuable, and we have, all of us, the possibility, as the persons we are, of unimaginable perfection. When he describes Buddhism as hopeless, when I read this, I was reminded of something. One of the gifts that's been given to me in this role is I move in this new, having left the deanship of Regent College, I teach there still part-time, I've moved into a role as the executive director of a mission agency, and my world takes me on a triad between the church, the academy, and the corporate business world. I don't know, I didn't see that coming, and it's just, but that's where I spend my days, that's where my phone calls today were to business people. I love it. I love this being in this. I just think what lucky people get to move in that triad. And one of the things that's emerged out of that is an opportunity to speak to people in business about the theological and spiritual contours of their work. And often they don't feel that the church speaks about these things. And where I've been given a regular chance to do it is in Hong Kong. In fact, I'm lecturing on that topic in Hong Kong in 2 weeks. But 2 years ago, when I lectured in Hong Kong at the Chinese University at the Center for Entrepreneurship, they had three scholars come, a Christian, a Buddhist, and a Confucian scholar, asking each of them to say, what does your religious tradition have to offer those of us in the school of business on entrepreneurship? To speak about entrepreneurship from within your own theological tradition. But before I'd read Williams, I decided of all the things I could say about entrepreneurship, I could speak about how God is creative and innovative and all kinds of stuff that I will... No, I'll be delighted to give it to you tonight, but it's not my assignment. But I decided to say this. Most of all, what an entrepreneur is an individual of hope who refuses to see the current circumstances as the last word. And I don't know where my instincts were, but the Buddhist was coming the next week. And I'm wondering, I'm hoping that somehow you'll see that I wanted to say to Christian people who do business in Hong Kong, when people say that Hong Kong has given up hope as a business community, Christians demonstrate that hope in the very character of their work. And of course, I was reminded of it when I stumbled upon Paul Williams' lines, that Buddhism is essentially hopeless. A stunning description.